I am joined by the local historian and author, Colm Liddy, who's here for our latest History and Focus slot. A very good morning to you, Colm.
Good morning, Al.
Thanks very much for coming in. So the last time you were with us, we were talking about the isms. It felt like every ism under the sun. We learned from racism begun in Ireland. Where are we moving to next?
Well, another big change during this era was to Christianity. As I'd said to you before, Christianity, after the initial heroic phase of the likes of St. Patrick and our local guys, Senan and Cayman, had, to be honest, gone into a bit of a slump. It was a two-tier Christianity. You had a hardcore who were into it and practicing and indeed repenting the whole time for their sins, and then a massive amount of people who didn't seem to give a hoot. And they were nominally Christians, but they weren't going to Mass, they weren't having the sacraments. Incredibly, they weren't even being buried on consecrated ground.
Sorry, is this the 12th century you're talking about, or 2024?
You know, I know. One has the impression like that Christianity was always astoundingly good in Ireland, yeah, into the past. But it's really the period of being ultra religious was really only about 150 years, you could say, from more or less 1850 to the year 2000. But going back to this time, not only would say are they not practicing too much, but there's a few things that the church don't like. For instance, there's very easy divorce in Ireland at that time. It's more or less just once love breaks down, that's it.
As Paddy McAloon once sang,
they just move on. And indeed, looking at the actual priests and the church, it was there was no proper organisation of it. It was just monasteries here and there, a lot of private little churches, and the actual priests were generally speaking in families. I mean, priest, son of a priest. I mean, families owned the land. So they weren't going to just give that land away to the church. They held it.
Yeah, you talked about that recently, that being a priest was very much a job, and it was kept within one family as opposed to anyone could apply and study to, yeah, become one.
The most spectacular example that's still there today, in a way, is the legacy of it is the word they had for the person who looks after church land is Éireannach, Éireannach. And then if you were the son of you were Mac Éireannach. And that's the word McInerney. The entire McInerney clan are essentially the people who looked after churches and were hereditary priests back, you know, 1,000 years ago, the entire lot of them.
There you go, McInerneys. In case you weren't aware of that, you are now. So was it the McInerneys who spearheaded the reform?
Well, no. From the year 1000, then, the church began to wake up. As I say, it had reached an absolute low when Pope John XII died in his bed of a heart attack with a woman in there with him, in his bed, you know. So from there, things began to improve.
You can finish the picture yourselves, boys and girls.
One lad, for instance, at this around this time, one pope we had was Pope Innocent III. He was hardcore and looking to establish a proper version of Christianity. So hardcore that, for instance, I recently last summer visited the town of Béziers in France. You can go there easily by Ryanair. I highly recommend it. Well, guess he just decided to massacre everybody in that city because they were not practicing Christianity properly.
So he really lived up to his name, Pope Innocent.
20,000 people, men, women and children, killed in Béziers during this era. Another great pope at this time was Pope Adrian. He's the only English pope there's ever been and likely to remain so. But Pope Adrian decided that we were such a disgrace that he actually wrote a papal bull for the Normans telling them that they could invade Ireland just to sort us out. So that was part of the problem with the Normans. They actually had written permission from this English pope, you know, saying that they could come and improve the quality of Christianity in Ireland. But thankfully, I would say also England just wanted the Canterbury, which was the centre of Christianity. They felt that they should be in charge. But we were quite lucky in that it was actually a clergyman who decided that it would happen from within ourselves. I mentioned before Murkertig O'Brien. He was like one of the descendants of Brian Boru, and he was the one who, you might recall, contemplated invading England when he formed an alliance with a Viking and whatnot, but it never came off. Well, that Murkertig, he felt that we needed to reform or else it was going to be done to us by outsiders.
Okay. I'm guessing it was the latter rather than the former.
Well, first of all, Murucurtie, he called a synod, as they call it, in Cashel in the year 1101. And very significant. He got the ball rolling to try and get things together. Edge Cashel was just, if you like, a fortress for the kings of Munster, which he was at that time. But he gave it to the church, and it's from that date. And they started the idea of diocese. There was no diocese in Ireland. It was, to say, it was just willy-nilly monasteries and private churches. So the dioceses were set up at that stage. And indeed, that's the reason why the one we're in, Killaloe, is such a strange shape. If you know it, it starts, you know, in Kilrush and stretches all the way to, I think, Burr, County Offaly is in it. That relates to the contours of Thomond at that time. So it, most of them, if you like, of when you look at the diocese and you wonder what sense they make, the answer is those were the chieftains that were at the negotiating table in 1101 at that time. Also, at this stage, he started inviting in orders from outside. And that's when you get the friary in Ennis kicks off with these, and also the Cistercians came to Corcomroe, and the Augustinians came to both Cannon Island, Clare Abbey, and they set up one for nuns in Killone. All that dates from this era.
So in terms of bringing Christianity to Ireland, Colm, you know, how receptive or difficult did the natives prove to be? Was there much resistance? Was there much bloodshed, like in Béziers, to try and convince the locals that it's in your best interests to become Christians?
Well, you'd be glad to know there was both, you know, for,
a nice mixture.
So, yes, huge resistance from the Irish population. They'd like, you know, we'd gotten into a nice pattern which had lasted quite well for 600 or 700 years, and now essentially a lot of foreigners were coming in, because a lot of these orders were brought in, such as the Cistercians. That's a French order, for instance. And they were coming in telling us what to do. So what's amusing is an inspector actually came from England in the year 1228. He wrote a book about his experiences here in Ireland, and his name was Stephen of Lexington. So this book, written in 1228, it's quite an amusing yarn from our perspective, because he comes in and he goes around all of the Cistercian monasteries in Ireland, which includes Corcomroe. Mellifont is kind of the big one up in Leinster. But he goes around them all and he finds that we're doing 97 things wrong.
Just the 97.
Okay, so we'll read out some of his complaints. Now, at the serious end of it, he notes that these monasteries all have some little sheds outside the front gate. And in the little sheds, sometimes nuns go out to those sheds, and sometimes local women go to those sheds. What happens after that, he does not know, but he calls it an occasion of sin. And quite likely, he wanted those sheds demolished. There was all sorts of skullduggery to do with money and property. Still, the notion of which tribes owned areas was a problem. He said that he found quite a few of the monks were eating extra meals, coming down to the kitchen after dark. They were also coming down for extra helpings of beer. Now, everybody was drinking beer, fine. That was to do with the quality of the water. In the medieval times, it was better to drink beer because you knew it wasn't actually polluted where so much water was. So they're drinking beer. He notes that they're gadding about in the locality in a frivolous manner. They're breaking silence. They're wearing fancy clothes under their cowls.
Ooh.
Yes, wearing fancy belts and all sorts of things. But some of them are even more amusing to me. One is, he said that the mass, it needed to be said more slowly, with more pauses. The Irish priests were saying it too quickly.
I think even people today might disagree with him, never mind back in the 13th century.
He also found that, you know this thing monks do where they chant? They chant certain things. The Irish monks were doing harmonies. That's not allowed. There is to be no harmonies.
We don't want the Beach Boys until the 1960s, not the 1230s.
So anyway, he wrote these 97 things, and he ultimately, it came down to three levels of punishment, depending on how severity. The first was being put on bread and water. The second was whipping and flogging. And then finally, excommunication. So throughout all of the monasteries, including Corcomroe, he singled out various individuals for these punishments.
Some of these problems I can see how he could easily observe these just going about his business, but the noting the monks are coming down for extra portions of food and beer, is he like hiding behind the curtains and in the drapes inside the monastery? What's he doing sitting in the dark waiting for them to come down?
This Stephen of Lexington.
Okay, so he finds these litany of problems. He recommends cold, hard solutions. How do things progress from there?
Well, obviously, it spreads amongst the various monasteries that he's on the prowl. The inspector is calling, and it reaches a climax when he approaches one that is in Thomond at that time. It's actually now in County Limerick, just outside of Croom. The ruins of it are still there. It's called Monaster. And I went down there the other day. It's a dead ringer for Cork and Roe. You know, you can see the O'Briens built it as well, so it's basically the same building. Except it. And it's just there in a field in Limerick. There isn't a sign in the world. It's hard to find, but there it is, this ruin. Well, anyway, it was being run at that stage by a certain O'Brien. All we have his name is that he's Monk T. They don't give his name, but let's say Turlock, most likely. Turlock or Tighe. But Monk T, anyway, is running it. Anyway, the French are invited in to kind of revamp it. Stephen of Lexington has sent them in to take over. And there's huge resistance. Again, it's just there's the language difference, you know, and everything, and they're bringing in new rules. So actually, the Irish monks, led by this clear man, T, Monk T, ejects the French ones, and they basically set up for a battle. They turn the abbey into a fortress. They pile up earth and stones. They get weapons. And most incredibly, they know that there's going to be a siege. They fill the church part of it with hay. They bring in 30 head of bullocks and put them in the cloister. This is all now in Stephen of Lexington's account of this outrage. I mean, he is going spare at these Irish people and what they're capable of. He calls, of course, Monk T a degenerate. Indeed, it's fairly hardcore behaviour. So anyway, the monks with their 30 head of cattle and their hay in the church, they're in for the long haul and a siege begins. Stephen and co arrive down at the thing, but the Bishop of Limerick is implored and he brings a load of warlike, shall we say, priests. So incredibly, a battle takes place between monks on the one hand and priests and some lay people on the other, led by the Bishop of Limerick. And ultimately, they break the siege and get in.
These are meant to be religious people, by the way.
Yes, it's incredible. I'm telling you, it's all there. I mean, the man is in despair. Eventually, he leaves. Goes back to England.
Never to leave Lexington for Ireland ever again.
No.
Okay, so that's pretty much a climax in the conflict. What is the legacy then for the country and its acceptance, in inverted commas, of Christianity?
Well, of course, the dioceses were set up at this time and they have largely stayed intact since. And as I say, and that's the reason for their strange shape and contours. They don't follow counties, as you know. Also, church building kicked off in a big way at this era. To be honest, there is almost no churches in Ireland or in Clare that are like from the 600s or the 700s, because mostly they were built of wood at that time. Yeah. But now they start making them in stone, and we're lucky. I mean, Clare is steeped in history of the places that are built in the years between 1000 and 1200, 1300. You know, we have dozens of them. I have to say that as regards the reform of behaviour, whereas the laity did begin to cop themselves on and they weren't divorcing as much and they started going to sacraments, the priests priests were harder nut to crack, and you still have letters in, there's a papal calendar of all the letters the Pope wrote to us, and if you look in the 1400s, you'll still see him having to make special allowances for Cork and Roe, that again, this particular fellow who is a son of a priest wants to become the abbot of Cork and Roe, and he's going, well, okay, fine, you're the best candidate, and special allowances are being made. So it was astonishing, really, how that behaviour kept going right up until the Reformation.
So a case of do as I say, not as I do.
Indeed. Okay. One final thing, actually, that's in Stephen's letters is, and he was encouraging the Irish to get behind, but we, again, weren't doing it. He wanted them to do bloodletting. Apparently this was a thing in the more hardcore monasteries at that time. 4 times a year you bled a little bit of you know, blood out. It was meant to basically improve your health and indeed your piety. I suppose the energy levels would drop down and you wouldn't have the energy to be doing bold things.
There's a movie in the Stephen from Lexington individual. I'm glad a lot of his theories didn't catch on. But that is an interesting point which to break. Any sneak preview as to where our journey takes us next in our next instalment, Colin?
Well, I'll tell you what, I've mentioned the church building in Clare during that era. Next week, I'm going to talk about my top 10 church ruins in Clare. Because honestly, I think everybody this summer, if you don't get away, you know, to a proper foreign holiday in Lanzarote, why not contemplate visiting the church ruins of Clare, of which we have dozens, and I'll talk about my top 10.
There you go. There's a top 10 you never thought you'd hear, but it's going to come your way regardless. Colin Liddy, the local historian and author. Thank you as ever, sir, and we'll talk to you again the next time.
Great. Thank you, Alan.